Forum here on the Uhuru Radio Network, where we expand our ability to communicate and unite the struggles of African people towards victory and independence in our lifetime. I'm Ron Bob Semple, and welcome back. I was away last weekend, and here on the Forum, we'll examine issues that affect Caribbean and Caribbean American nationals, both at home and across the diaspora. We'll bring you news, views, interviews, thought-provoking discussions, Caribbean theater of the mind, and of course, musical interludes. Yes, it was 15 years ago today when nearly 1 million black men assembled peacefully and purposefully on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. The powerful visual image that the march projected of so many black men gathered in solidarity was unlike anything that had been seen in this country before. Did the march capitalize on all that energy by providing concrete ideas for how to go home and build the institutions and infrastructure that we need to make real demands on the government? The unemployment percentage of black youth in New York is over 50%. At the time of the march, Congress had already passed the North American Free Trade Agreement, and the Clinton administration had eliminated inmate educational programs and accelerated the growth in the nation's industrial prison complex. But these decisions had a greater impact on black men than on any other demographic group. The leader of the Nation of Islam, Louis Farrakhan, will be in the Tampa Bay area this weekend to mark this 15th anniversary of the Million Man March. Yes, I remember traveling from New York to Washington, D.C. in the wee hours of the morning, and ending up there on the mall, waiting for the sun to rise on that rather beautiful autumn morning. Well, on September 20th in 1758, Haiti's founding father, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, was born a slave under European ideology and put in chains to serve France and European nations in worldwide power. He lived to change the course of humanity. He was assassinated on October 17th in 1806. Well, joining us during our first hour will be author and historian Arnold Talleyrand, who has written several books about the history of Haiti, including L'Assassination de Jean-Jacques Dessalines, The Assassination of Jean-Jacques Dessalines. Professor Tony Martin, who is no stranger to this broadcast, will share with us the role that Jews played in the Caribbean slave trade. So tell someone that Caribbean Forum is on the air for the next 2 hours. We heard every Saturday from 9 to 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Uhuru Radio Network. Well, here is Steel Pulse in their special tribute to the devastated nation of Haiti. Hold on for Haiti.
Oh, yes. I know it's easy to say, don't let this earthquake get you down, as you hold your head and ball in times of sorrow. I know it's easy to say, when your back is up against the wall, don't be forsaken, no, 'cause there's tomorrow. Yes, hold on. As we all will share with you your devastation. I know it's easy to say, you got to keep your head up high, but we truly sympathize with your frustration. Yes, hold on.
How much we care.
Yes, I know that life is just for living and can be so unforgiving. Cause oftentimes we think there's no love. You must keep yourself believing and bear witness to your uprising.
Hold on for Haiti. And holding on the line with us this morning is author and historian Arnold Talleyrand, who's joining us this morning. Bonjour, monsieur. Good morning, Mr. Talleyrand. Welcome to Caribbean Forum, and welcome to the Uhuru Radio Network.
Bonjour, Juan. And I appreciate that you invited me to answer some question about the event that we celebrate tomorrow.
Yes, absolutely. Well, welcome here to Caribbean Forum. As I mentioned, that you are a historian and an author, and just like to ask you, coming out of the gate, did you feel that the history of Haiti was not being told as well as it should? And that's one of the reasons why you have embarked on penning these almost seven books dealing with the history of Haiti?
Yes, I agree with you. I'm not satisfied with the way they analyze it, or they interpret the event that happened since 1492. And that's why I'm trying to go back to history, go back to the event with other documents and present other aspects of the situation.
Arnold, why do you feel that the outer world does not know much about Haiti?
Keep going.
No, I was just, is it a deliberate act or in your estimation?
Yes, I think so. Why worry about Haiti? The same way the outer world knows nothing about Africa. They don't care. What they care is the life they can have by continuing exploiting the situation to keep inequality, to keep the exclusion of people, to keep the misery of a lot of people. And Haiti is part of that world.
Let's go back to 1492, as we all know, the inception when Christopher Columbus landed and claimed the island of Hispaniola for Spain. The Spanish built the New World's first settlement at La Navidad on Haiti's north coast. There's been a lot of confusion. Of course, earlier this week, there was Columbus Day, and there are a lot of historians and a lot of lay people who are of the impression that Christopher Columbus, who was supposed to have discovered so many lands that already existed, has left a question mark.
Yeah, I agree with you, but can you discover a land that belongs to other people? It's just a big lie. Because those people, they live in their land. They know what they're doing. They got a good life. And some people come from Europe and they said they discovered a land. How come you discover a land where people live on it? The problem is, European civilization, what they call Western civilization, want to have their first on everything they're doing. Nobody else exists before them. And that's why they keep saying that Columbus discovered, and it's a lie. In one of my books, If Sugar Could Talk, and I discuss the situation, and I show people that it's impossible that the Columbus can discover a land that belongs to another people. They conquest the land. They conquest, they kill the people. They conquest the land and they took their resources, the the resources, and they use them at their advantage. That's all.
Do you say that an almost similar thing happened to the Aborigines in Australia and the Native Americans here in this country?
Definitely. Definitely. The same thing that happened to Africa, too. You remember Victor Hugo when he said, Africa does not exist. Mm-hmm. People, Christian people, got to go there and take possession of the land. That's the same thing.
As we mentioned, tomorrow, October 17th, will be this celebration, if we can call it a celebration, of the assassination of Jean-Jacques Dessalines. You have written extensively on Dessalines. Just share with our listeners, Brother Arnold, some of the history that we may not know of Jean-Jacques Dessalines.
Well, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, when he died, they gave a version of his death, of the assassination, to please the outer world, because they want to build a conflict between free people in Haiti. And they called them mulattoes on one side, they called them Negroes on the other side. But I think the assassination of Dessalines is a more complex event, if I can say that. Because don't forget that Dessalines is a human being that lived three big periods on his life, and all the three periods were definitely focused on violence. We got the first period of his life where he was a slave, and it was a type of violence, the violence of the slave institution against the slave, and where he suffered all type of atrocities. And you got, the slave got no judicial status, no economical status, no political status. He was nobody. He belongs to somebody else. And they got the physical violence. And it was a total violence on one side, from the slave institution against the slave. The second type of violence started in 1791, where some slave or former slave or rebel or Mahon, like they called them, wanted to gain their own freedom, and they use violence against the slave institution, and the slave institution was using violence against them at the same time to maintain slavery. And it was the same actors, slave, human being on both sides, the one they kept on slavery to make them work to enrich European countries, and the slave institution, everybody in the slave institution, missionaries, agents, colonists, government, everybody, military people. And that was the second type of violence. When France got problem in Europe, they could not maintain the colony, and they used the free people to maintain the colony. And that's why you get another type of violence between free people. And what Etienne Charlier, an historian, called the fight between borders. And you get Toussaint versus Villade, Toussaint versus Rigaud, and Dessalines was part of it until we got 1804. And in 1804, the situation was worse, because it was based on violence. And based on violence to gain freedom. And they were scared of going back to slavery. And they didn't build a country. They built a fort to keep the country away from the arrival of another European forces.
Excuse me, Brother Arnold.
Yes.
Yes, if we can go back a tad to 1791, clarify for us how the slave rebellion that was launched by Jamaican-born Boukman, which led to that protracted 13-year war of liberation. How did that play into the conflict with Dessalines, as you mentioned, with the mulattoes on one side and the Negroes on the other side?
The question of Boukman is a clear question, because when you take the slave, it was very difficult for the slave to raise against the slavery system, and it was the rebel they call Mao. That's a bad word, but anyway, that's the way they called them. And they could get together under Boukman, and they said he's from Jamaica. They said anyway, he was a rebel. He was not a slave at the time.
Okay.
When they said that Boukman was a slave when he went against the slave institution, that's because in the mentality of the European, all black people are supposed to be slaves. And that's what they call them, free slaves. They don't call them rebels. They don't call them that they got themselves their own freedom. No, they said free slaves. This is because they were black, because they were Africans.
You didn't have to pay for them, huh?
That's right. And when they start fighting, they shook the system. And the system was never again the same one, because they lost their face.
Mm.
They lost their face, and they got to deal with them. And that was the first time. Well, that happened in Jamaica. That happened in Guadeloupe. They deal with them. The slave system deal with the rebellion. At the same time, they wanted them to keep slavery, to help them keep slavery. Now, that's why after 1794, when France accept to give the slave, their emancipation, the slave, not the free people, their emancipation, because they got their emancipation already by themselves, by fighting. But France gave, by decree, they gave them their emancipation, not their freedom. It was an emancipation that coming from one type of life, you are a slave, to another type of life where I give you some type of freedom.
Hmm.
Because they could not move from the plantation, from one plantation to another plantation. The only thing they gain is a type of salary, but they receive the same atrocities. They cut their leg, they cut their ears, they beat them up, because slavery was based on atrocities. And if you don't have force, military forces, how come you keep people in slavery?
Why was Dessalines' name forbidden to be spoken in Haiti? Under the threat of imprisonment?
I don't understand the question.
Just the mere fact that one may mention the name of Dessalines, one could have been imprisoned for even talking about him.
Today or...
No. Back in 1794, or prior to his assassination in 1806. Was he a threat to the white nations?
I don't think they talked that much about Dessalines at that time, because Dessalines was not known. Dessalines was a part of Jean-François Papillon's army. He was just a captain.
Okay.
But when they, the name of Dessalines became known as a very important personality in Saint-Domingue. That's when the La Guerre du Sud, the War of the South, start, because Toussaint gave him full power to destroy those people. But when Toussaint gave them full power to destroy the people, he didn't do it by himself. He was helped by the U.S. government at the time. Because I don't know if you are familiar to a letter that he sent to the President John Adams.
No.
Asking him, I thought it was August 1799, he asked the President John Adams to put his boats around the South to avoid any harm coming for the other people in the South, for Rigaud and Beauvais. Mm. And when they put an embargo over there, Rigaud got nothing to do. He could not receive food, he could not receive arms, and he was attacked by Toussaint and Dessalines, and it was a game for them to kill those people. And Dessalines became known as what Leclerc called le boucher des nègres, the butcher, black butcher. That's the way Leclerc called him.
And you said black butcher?
I was a ferocious guy. Yes.
If you've just joined us, we're chatting with Arnold Talleyrand, a historian and author, born in Haiti, a proud grandfather, I must say, of five. And he's joining us as we talk about Haiti, as most of us do know that November 28th, there will be the presidential elections in Haiti. And today, August 16th, at least about 10 of the presidential candidates will be in the Florida area, specifically St. Petersburg, conducting a forum. Brother Arnold, tell us about the women in Jean-Jacques Dessalines' life, his mother and his wife. Not much seems to be known about them.
Well, you know, according to the slave institution, a slave got no mother, no father, no family. He belongs to nobody. He comes from nowhere. They just saw him on a boat, and he landed on a plantation, because Africa does not exist. But Dessalines got there. There are two versions of his birth. Some people think he was born in Africa. Other people think he was born in Saint-Domingue. And that make a big difference, because when you are born in Africa, you are a Bosal. I don't know if you're familiar with that name.
No, that what does that mean?
You are a salvage. You with no idea of civilization. You don't know anything, because Africa is a jungle where animals run, not people. And that's the way the European people, the Western civilization, was thinking about Africa before. But if you were born in Saint-Domingue on a plantation where a colonist is in control, you are a Creole, somebody who been close to the colonists, and you are learning, you are closer to civilization. And Dessalines, who knows if he has a mother? Some people say he was born in 1758, and now 5 years ago they found out that he was born on September 20, but who knows? But for his wife, we know it, because he got married in 1801 mm-hmm. to a lady named Claire Heureuse.
Yes, okay. Marie Claire Heureuse.
But there was a conversation between Claire Rose and Dessalines that reported by Madieu, the historian, when Claire Rose asked him, why are you killing so many people? For no reason. It was in 1801. And he said, I'm a soldier. And the lady told him, but it is no reason to obey to people that that tell you to kill other people. He said, let me tell you something. If I don't kill them, they will kill me. And I think this is the basis so far of Haitian politics. Your rival is an enemy, and you have to kill him because there is no way you can compromise. When you are in power, you want absolute power. And that's the way Dessalines used the woman, with absolute power, because he got a mistress in every town in Saint-Domingue, in Haiti, after 1804. And his minister of finance was there to give the woman a check every month. And he was a powerful guy. But there was no, if you look at the Constitution of 1805, there is nothing about the development of the country. It was not an economical event. 1804 was not an economical event because they didn't change the system. The economic system, the colonial economic system, was still in function. Respect to the chief. You cannot move from one plantation to another plantation. The use of whip, and everybody was, you know, the majority of the people, they got no school. When you look at the constitution, you see one school per military division, and there was six military division. That means six school for all Saint-Domingue, because the school was for the children of the military generals. And there was a big problem in the country at the beginning, because there is no the same economic system was still in application, but they wanted to change the political system. That means it was not a colonist from Europe. It was a colonist, a non-European colonist. And it was very difficult to look at Dessalines the other way.
We're going to take a break in a moment, Brother Arnold. But just to go back, you had mentioned that there is no recorded history of Dessalines' mother, who she was identified as. I don't know if you know the Haitian historian and scholar Geoffrey Kayiti.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Excuse me. I was reading some information that he had mentioned Dessalines' mother. Her name was Elizabeth.
Yeah, Marie Elizabeth.
Right.
He was the one that says that Dessalines was born on September 20. But the problem is, when you affirm something like that, you got to bring documents.
Right, absolutely. And bring the
there
proof.
Is no birth certificate of Dessalines.
We're going to take a short break and here on Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple. We're chatting with Arnold Talleyrand, author and historian out of Haiti. We'll be right back after these very important words.
Black is back. Yes, Black is back. The Black is Back Coalition for Peace, Social Justice, and Reparations will lead a national march and rally on the White House in Washington, D.C. on November 13th this year, where young black men and Afghan men, women, and children dying as a result of U.S.-led wars of aggression in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, in Africa, and on the streets of the United States. It is time for the black community to stand up and say, hell no, we won't go. We oppose Obama's wars. Join the Black is Back Coalition in Washington, D.C. on November 13th. For more information, call 202-681-7040 or email info@blackisbackcoalition.org. For it on to D.C.
You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
Tune in to Africa Live with your host, Yabinga Zimbabwe, every Sunday at 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. as we discuss issues facing African people around the world, from Brooklyn to Brixton, Cameroon to Caracas, here on UhuruRadio.com.
Welcome back to Caribbean Forum. I'm Ron Bob Semple here on the Uhuru Radio Network. We're talking history. We're talking a history of Haiti. We know Haiti has been in the limelight, in the media, and all over the world since, since January 12th, that devastating earthquake that that cost the lives of over 200,000 Haitians and leaving over a million homeless. And I have made a promise to you listeners, as many of you have heard, that I will continue to keep Haiti in the forefront now that all the mainstream media has left. And joining us this morning to help keep Haiti alive, and the name of Haiti alive, is historian Arnel Talleyrand. Brother Arnel, just before the break, we were talking about the history, the work that you have been doing. And here in the United States, there's a lot of history that has been deliberately kept out of the school system. In Jamaica, there are a lot of nationals who were not schooled on exactly who Marcus Garvey was.
Mm-hmm.
How much of this history is being taught in Haiti to the young people?
Well, let me tell you something. First of all, you get about 70% of the school of the kids in Haiti, they're not going to school.
70%?
70%.
Is this before or after the earthquake?
I think it's before the earthquake. The earthquake has not changed the situation, except that a lot of schools were broken, and a lot of kids went stay out of school. But before the earthquake, I'm talking before the earthquake, you got 70% of the kids not going to school. Because most of the people, they're looking at Port-au-Prince and the big cities. But you got to go outside on the country to see how bad it is. But what is, we got an official history since 1923. And that's the same story that taught to the kids in Haiti. And most of the people, they know only one version, because really, the history of Haiti, for me, is not written the way it's supposed to be written. And it's written based on emotion, and the colonists wanted us, Haitian, or probably Jamaican too, to see history based on white and black. and they never show history based on the economic situation. When they coming to conquest, they came for economic reason. And until now, until today, when you are studying the history of the Caribbean or Latin America, you don't see that in the books. And this is one of my problems. I am trying to make sure that, try to restore that situation and show the people that there is another version.
But looking at the history of Haiti, Brother Arnold, excuse me, that, you know, the first black republic in this part of this hemisphere, and Haiti had been so rich. What has happened? What has caused that economic breakdown in Haiti over the years?
Okay. Economy, Haiti was so rich when? Before 1789, when they call her the pearl of the Caribbean.
Okay.
But it was based on the rich country was based on slavery, forcing people with force to work on plantation, and everything that the profits were not for the slave, the profits were for the European countries. And I don't see how they can see that Haiti was rich. In 1804, Haiti was a country devastated by war, devastated by the burning of the plantation between 1791 to 1794.
What about natural resources?
Well, natural resources, we got them. But who is thinking about that in Haiti until now in 2010?
Right, but that was the richness I was referring to.
But the resources, they kept they are controlled by the international community. They are not controlled by Haitians.
Mm-hmm.
And calling Haiti a rich country is probably saying that they got. You got the money in the bank, but you can't do nothing with the money. You cannot take the money out from the bank. Are you rich?
Mm.
And nobody because don't forget the international community got the power, military power, to keep those countries in more or less in poverty. And they care about their own development, not the development of the country. But there is still one aspect of Haitian politics, probably that's our disease, that we don't know what's good, what's right, and what's how to keep a country clean. This is our problem, because we could do that part. At least the basic, like they do in Jamaica, like they do in Trinidad, like they do in other Caribbean countries. But we don't see that in Haiti.
Do you feel now that the January 12th earthquake has, excuse me, has devastated the infrastructure of Haiti, that the leadership, well, hopefully the new leadership come November 29th, would make a concerted effort to correct some of the issues that we're talking about now, as far as knowing the history of the land? What positiveness you think can come out of this devastation that Haiti experienced almost 10 months ago?
Well, I got the hope, like everybody else, that something will come and we will change our mentality. But it's very difficult. When I'm looking at the newspaper, Le Nouveliste, the day before yesterday, it was raining in Port-au-Prince, in south of Port-au-Prince, and nobody, even people, could not walk to go through Carrefour because it was so bad and smelling. So that does mean it is not the earthquake. It is, I think it's our way of life.
Mm.
Our way of life. I'm talking about Haitian. That's why I said I hope that we get a new leadership that can do something at least to keep the country going forward. I hope.
What can Arnold Talleyrand contribute to this new Haiti?
Well, my contribution is trying to go back on history and telling the truth. Because if you don't know yourself, you cannot go forward. This is my position. And I'm trying to go back on history and tell them there is another way to see the situation. There is another way you can analyze the event, the past event, and to see the question, well, differently.
Well, I know that Haiti and Haitians are peacefully waiting for a change. It's been a rocky road since the first president, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, back in 1804. To date, they have been at least 50 or 55 presidents of the country. Many have been overthrown. A few have served their full term, and a couple have been assassinated. We know that Haiti is important to the region. It's important to the region, and I certainly hope that Haitians outside of Haiti can think like one Arnold Talleyrand, in that you feel that there is need to go back and contribute in whatever shape, fashion, or form that you can. What's next for Arnold Talleyrand, my brother? Any other books in the pipeline?
Yes, but before I answer that,
yes,
you cannot think about going forward if the politics of exclusion is still in application.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
You cannot keep the people, the majority of the people, away from Haitian life, the reality. You cannot keep equality or inequality as a basic for your political system. And you, if you look at it, Wednesday, there was an article in the news that say the Canadian government, not the Haitian government, the Canadian government worked for 2 months, August and September, to give an identity card to 4.7 million Haitians.
Yep.
And that's been since 1804. You see how many people were never registered to the government?
That's right.
And how come you keep a country like that? If you want to go forward, how come you keep the same atrocities against the same majority and you want to go forward? And can we still hide those crimes? We got to talk about it. We got to sit down and stop pointing our fingers to others. And we got to sit down and discuss the situation to see what happened, because they, by hiding those crimes, you are hiding your own intention to the majority. Well, your second part of the question, yes, I got a book coming, and it's about the invention of privileged group. And I'm talking about the same period, from 1492 to 1804.
Well, all the best to you, my brother, and for those of you who are listening here in the Tampa Bay region, and also throughout the global network, Brother Talleyrand will be speaking this evening much more extensively on the assassination of Jean-Jacques Dessalines at the Haitian Association Foundation of Tampa Bay. And that will be this evening, October 16th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at the University Area Community Development Center, located at 14013 North 22nd Street in Tampa. And if you cannot attend this meeting, you have the ability to listen in on a conference call. And that telephone number is 218-936-1200, and the access code is 416-2558. Brother Arnold, thank you very much for spending this time with us here on Caribbean 4, and we look forward to having you join us in the future.
I'm the one to say thank you to you. I appreciate that.
Okay, bonsoir.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Yes, you've been listening to Arnold Talleyrand, historian and author of 7 books, including The Assassination of Jean-Jacques Dessalines, here on Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple, on the Uhuru Radio Network. We'll be right back after we take a break, and we'll bring to you just the Caribbean news in brief.
You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
Set sail with the Uhuru Movement and the African People's Socialist Party on December 12th through 18th for a 7-day cruise to Key West, Grand Cayman, and Ocho Rios, Jamaica, aboard the luxurious Carnival Freedom cruise ship. Special guests include our very own Chairman Omali Eshetela, leader of the Uhuru Movement, and the very talented Ron Bob Semple, creator of The Spirit of Marcus Garvey, a one-man show in which Semple delivers an uncanny exactness of the legendary Garvey, transporting the onlooker back to the time of the revolutionary spirit that gave birth to the African Socialist International. Cabin prices are from $519 per person. Double occupancy and deposits start as low as $50 today, $250 by July 12th. For more information, please visit our website at uhurulegacycruise.com. That's uhurulegacycruise.com. Book your room today with Tanya's Travel by calling 352-232-2131 or by email at tanyastravel@bellsouth.net. We hope you all can set sail with us on the ship named for our struggle, freedom. Uhuru.
And now for the Caribbean news in brief. Jailed Jamaican reggae artist Buju Banton, whose real name is Mark Myrie, was offered $250,000 bail in a Tampa federal court this week. However, he's still not in the clear, as his lawyer, David Oscar Marcus, will now have to seek bond in the immigration court to prevent his deportation to Jamaica. Banton's entertainment visa was revoked when he was arrested on cocaine-related charges last December. As part of bail condition, he will have to wear a monitoring device and will be subject to house arrest and 24-hour security. The reggae star will be retried in December after a panel of jurors failed to come to a unified decision last month on his guilt or innocence. The Ghana Parliament has approved an amendment to its criminal laws abolishing the mandatory death penalty for murder. The death penalty can still be imposed on a person found guilty of certain homicides. However, judges now also have the option of sentencing those found guilty of murder to terms of imprisonment. There are over 40 people on death row in Guyana and more than 50 awaiting trial for murder. The last execution in the South American nation was in 1997. The World Health Organization, the WHO, has issued its first report on 17 neglected tropical diseases such as dengue fever, rabies, and leprosy that affect mainly poor people. The United Nations health body said that dengue, the mosquito-transmitted virus, already endemic in the Caribbean, was rapidly spreading worldwide. The news wasn't all bleak, as WHO Director General Margaret Chan said that some progress had been made in tackling some diseases, such as Guinea worm disease. The organization feels that it can substantially reduce the prevalence of the diseases with the help of drug donations from the pharmaceutical industry. Earlier this week, the world was riveted to television sets watching the hair-raising and heart-fluttering rescue of the 33 Chilean miners who were trapped about a half a mile under the surface of the earth for some 69 days. There has been an outpouring of assistance to the miners and their families, including book and movie deals, from which all the men will profit. Jamaica has not been left out. Deeply touched by the courageous spirit of the rescued miners, Jamaica's Minister of Tourism and Foreign Affairs and Foreign Trade, Edmund Bartlett, announced that his government has partnered with Sandals Resorts International to offer the miners, rescue workers, and their spouses a relaxing Jamaican vacation. Well, finally, this month of October has been rather significant in more ways than one. Of course, last Sunday, the calendar date was 10-10-10. But more intriguingly, in 823 years, this month has had five Fridays, five Saturdays, and five Sundays. That's the Caribbean News in Brief with me, Ron Bob Semple, here on the Uhuru Radio Network. We're here every Saturday from 9 to 11 Eastern Standard Time. Tell a friend, tell a friend, tell a friend. The Mighty Sparrow, as only he can do it.
I'm a slave from a land so far. I was caught and I was brought here from Africa. I'm a slave from a land so far. I was caught and I was brought here from Africa. Well, it was licks like fire from the white slave master every day. And down on my knees, weeks and weeks before we crossed the seas to reach in the West Indies. Then they make me work. I said I work.
Yes, I work.
Good Lord, no pay. I toil, I toil, I toil. I say I toil so hard each day. I'm dying. I'm slave master standing there with the gun. Oh, I know he gonna shoot to kill. So I stay and I pray, but I'm planning still. I study night and day how to break away. I got to make a brilliant escape. But every time I think about the whip and them dogs, my body does start to shake. He made me work.
Yes, I work.
I said I work.
Yes, I work.
Oh, oh, Lord, no pay. I toil, I toil, I toil, I toil, I toil hard each day. I'm dying. I'm crying. Thank you. that the boss would listen to me someday. Although he knew my request was small, 'twas the sting of the whip there to answer me when I call. We had to chant and sing to express our feeling to that wicked and cruel man. That was the only medicine to make him listen. And his so-calypso began. He made me work.
Yes,
and said I work. Oh, oh, Lord, no pay. I toil, I say I toil hard each day. I'm dying. I'm
only one Slinger Francisco. There's only one Mighty Sparrow. There's only one Calypso King of the World. Yeah, that was the Mighty Sparrow singing about the slave. I want to be free. And we're going to get an opportunity now to listen to Professor Tony Martin. He's the author of several books, including Race First. He's also written a book on one of the wives of Marcus Garvey. And he did join us on the broadcast here about a month ago. I'd just like to share with you a lecture that Tony Martin gave in Kentucky. It was somewhat controversial while he was lecturing there at a college in Massachusetts. Here is Tony Martin on the Jewish role in the Caribbean slave trade.
Prominently present in non-Dutch parts of the Caribbean, places like Barbados, places like Jamaica, St. Thomas, and many of the other islands as well. That has arisen concerning history, as I think everyone here will recognize, is perhaps the most contentious of all subjects. But the fact that history is a contentious subject, subject to varying interpretations, is no reason, I believe, to justify the effort which has become somewhat widespread in recent years to attempt to criminalize dissenting historical opinions, to either criminalize those opinions literally or sometimes to subject those who hold differing opinions to widespread vilification. So I endorse the notion then of real history. History is controversial, it is contentious, but differences of opinion, I think, in the historical profession ought to be debated, ought to be fought out in the broad arena of ideas, and hopefully in time the correct ideas will prevail, hopefully, and incorrect ideas will die. The topic which I hope to deal with today is the controversies, recent controversies surrounding the question of the African slave trade, that is the slave trade in African people across the Atlantic Ocean. So that's the controversies which have arisen surrounding that question of the transatlantic slave trade. Slavery, as we know, has been historically an almost universal institution. I suspect that there must be very, very few societies that have not, at one time or another, experienced slavery. Karl Marx argued that slavery was one of the basic stages that Western European society went through after what he called primitive communism and preceding feudalism and so on. As one looks around the world at other societies, one sees examples of slavery just about every place. Slavery in ancient Greece is very well known. There's a very famous quotation from the Roman politician and man of letters, Cicero, in which he wrote to some friend of his one time, suggesting to that friend that when he went to buy slaves, that he should avoid buying English slaves because they were so stupid, ignorant. He thought that a guy would be wasting his money. In fact, it's very fascinating because the kinds of stereotypes that Cicero was putting forward in relation to English slaves were not that different from the kinds of stereotypes that developed later on pertaining to African slaves. So slavery then has been a very universal experience. Nevertheless, it has been a very controversial experience, and it continues to be a very controversial experience. One of the very first controversies surrounding slavery is a question of defining slavery. What precisely is slavery? A variety of different types of human condition have been described over the years as slavery. For example, serfdom in Europe has been described on occasion as being slavery. Sometimes, when speaking of the African situation prior to the transatlantic slave trade, sometimes historians have used the expression domestic slavery to try to differentiate the kind of so-called slavery that existed on the African continent prior to the transatlantic slave trade with what eventually developed in the Americas and elsewhere. Domestic slavery is said to have been something akin to domestic servitude, where those who were slaves had a certain amount of social mobility and weren't necessarily subjected to the kind of harsh regime that developed in the Americas later on. We have the term slavery applied to what in some history books has come to be known as white slavery, the white slave trade. I believe it was 1910 in the United States of America when an act was passed against so-called white slavery, the Mann Act. I think it was 1910. And white slavery supposedly was a slave, not supposedly, it was a trade in women, many of whom apparently were Jewish women coming out of Central Europe, and a trade which, notwithstanding the fact that the women were Jews, a trade which apparently was prosecuted by Jewish entrepreneurs, it was a global trade in which apparently women were sent from Europe across the world to act as prostitutes and so on. This was in the 19th century and into the early 20th century as well. So the term slavery has been applied to that situation, so-called white slavery, the white slave trade. There are many other controversies concerning slavery at all different periods in history. For example, there's a controversy which is raging right now concerning whether Jews were enslaved in ancient Egypt. You know, there's been a body of thought over the years relying on biblical sources and whatnot, suggesting, well, supposedly relying on biblical sources, suggesting that Jews were enslaved in ancient Egypt. There's another body of thought which argues that there's no real evidence for Jews having been enslaved in ancient Egypt. So that's another controversy which has arisen. There's a controversy concerning slave labor in Egypt, period, among indigenous ancient Egyptians. There's a body of thought that suggests that the pyramids of ancient Egypt were constructed by slave labor. There's a contrary body of thought which suggests that no, there was no slave labor. It was a question of peasants being used as construction workers at a time because of the inundation of the Nile Valley at a time when, you know, life was relatively slow, etc., etc. One of the biggest controversies concerning slavery arose in the context of the transatlantic slave trade on the question of the relationship between capitalism and slavery. In fact, that precise phrase was the title of one of the outstanding books on the slave trade, Capitalism and Slavery, a book written by Eric Williams, a man who subsequently became Prime Minister of Trinidad and Tobago. And Eric Williams argued that the rise of the capitalism in Europe and the Industrial Revolution, more precisely in England in the late 1700s, was a direct consequence, he argued, of the super profits, the unprecedented accumulation of capital that took place as a result of the transatlantic slave trade. Williams attempted to document this thesis in very, very minute detail. Nevertheless, this has remained an area of great controversy, perhaps one of the greatest areas of controversy around slavery and the slave trade. Was the slave trade the reason for the great accumulation of capital that made the Industrial Revolution possible in England and subsequently in the rest of Europe? Yet another of the great controversies that has arisen and that continues to rage around the question of slavery is the question of statistics pertaining to the African slave trade across the Atlantic. How many Africans perished in that slave trade? Estimates run anything from 8 or 9 million to 600 million. Black historians have tended to be on the largest side of those estimates, and other historians have often tended to be towards the more conservative estimates. I don't think anybody will ever know precisely how many people died. Suffice it to say that many died in Africa itself before they ever made it to a slave ship. Sometimes slaves were obtained as much as 1,000 miles inland from the shore. And it was a very arduous journey from wherever slaves were obtained very often to the shore. Once they got to the shore areas, there sometimes was a period of waiting in harsh conditions, while they awaited the arrival of a slave ship and so on. A conventional figure that we often see is that mortality across the Atlantic, that is during what they call the Middle Passage, the trip from West Africa to the Americas. It is said in many books that the mortality during that Middle Passage was something like 33%. This in itself, I'm sure, is a figure that's subject to some controversy. But it is suggested very often that maybe 1 in 3 of each of those, those Africans who was embarked on a ship, a slave ship, on the West African coast was dead before they even arrived in the Americas. C.L.R. James, the man who has written a definitive history of the Haitian Revolution, C.L.R. James says in his famous book, The Black Jacobins, that the life expectancy for an African slave arriving in Haiti was 6 years. So those African slaves who survived that 1,000 miles or maybe less journey from the interior of Africa to the coast, and who then survived that, those were the most hardy of the Africans, the ones who were able to survive that arduous experience. Once they got to Haiti, C.L.R. James suggests, they were dead, most of them within 6 years. The life expectancy was 6 years. He says that it was, from a purely economic perspective, it was better for the planters to work slaves literally to death in Haiti, literally to death, than import new ones, rather than keep them alive, treat them well, and then have to deal with diminishing returns as time went on, as they became older, as they became a charge on the plantation, as they were unable to work, etc. It is perhaps because of some of these controversies that the term chattel slavery has been advanced by some historians in relation to the kind of slavery that developed in the Americas. Because the term slavery has come to cover so many types of situations, some historians have used the term chattel slavery to describe slavery as it existed in our part of the world here in the Americas. Chattel, from the English word meaning cattle, chattel, as in cattle, indicating that human beings in this kind of slavery were treated like animals, like cattle, in a way that perhaps was not necessarily always present in slavery in other places. Perhaps that kind of debasement of the human spirit perhaps was not as prevalent perhaps in serfdom in Europe or maybe in domestic slavery in Africa, etc. So the term chattel slavery then is one reflection of an effort to come to grips with at least one aspect of these many controversies concerning the slave trade. Another controversy pertains to the question of what kind of institution slavery was in the Americas. Was it a benign institution? Were the slaves happy? Did they cry when their master died? Did they bow and scrape? Did they become Sambo characters? Sambo is a term that some historians have come up with to describe a kind of personality whereby Africans supposedly acquiesce, I guess, in the institution of slavery. They like being subjected, they like being enslaved and so on. They became childlike, etc. So were they Samoans? Did they like slavery? Were they mostly rebellious? Was slavery a harsh institution? Was it a mild institution? All of these are areas around which controversy has raged. There's a historian back in the 1940s, a man called Tannenbaum, who put forward yet another controversial thesis. He argued that slavery was milder in the Portuguese and Spanish territories in the Americas than it was in the Protestant territories. He argued that the Portuguese in places like Brazil and the Spaniards and other places were prone to miscegenation, and as far as he was concerned, miscegenation was some kind of an indicator of madness. My own argument is that nothing could be further from the truth. Miscegenation simply meant that slave owners had access, sexual access, to their slave women and took advantage of that situation. But miscegenation outside of marriage is not, you know, ipso facto and per se evidence of anything except access to women who were defenseless. But nevertheless, you had a historian, Tannenbaum, arguing that there was a great deal of miscegenation, he said, in Latin America. I'm not even sure if he was correct in suggesting that there was more miscegenation in Brazil, say, than in the southern United States. And his very premise, I'm not sure if it was correct. I doubt very much whether there could have been more miscegenation in Brazil or Cuba or someplace like that than there was in New Orleans or Charleston, South Carolina. Maybe here in Hebron, Kentucky, who knows? I don't know much about Kentucky. Nevertheless, I mention this again just to give you a sort of a sense of how controversial a thing this question of slavery has been and will continue to be. This brings me to the role of Jews in the African slave trade. I have been a teacher of black history for many years, 30 or more years. And of course, as a teacher of black history, one obviously has to be acquainted with the question of slavery and the slave trade. I never really considered myself a great specialist in the slave trade per se, even though I was acquainted with it in a general way. But of course, circumstances conspired to cause me to look closely at this aspect of black history, especially the question of Jews in the African slave trade. Now, the question of Jews in the African slave trade is one which I, despite the fact that I was a professor of African history for many years, it's a question that I was only dimly aware of. I had come across a little reference someplace suggesting that there was a Jewish presence in the African slave trade. But now that I am more aware of the role that Jews played, it strikes me as very interesting that I could have taught African history and black history generally, African-American history, Caribbean history for so long without having a clearer sense of the involvement of Jews in that nefarious trade. And it seems to me that as I look back on this reality, it seems to me that somewhere along the line, there must have been perhaps a deliberate tendency on the part of somebody, I'm not sure who, maybe book publishers, maybe historians themselves, but it seems as though there was a tendency over the years to downplay, to deliberately downplay and to obscure, to camouflage the role of Jews in the African slave trade. Now I realize that many of the people who I now know to have been Jews, who played an important role in the slave trade, were described in history books as just white or Portuguese or Spaniards or whatever. There was a tendency, and there still is a tendency, you know, whenever Jews were involved, if it was something concerning which Jews were proud, then that person would be identified as a Jew. If it was something that concerning which Jews maybe felt that, you know, that it might cause a bad reflection on their kind, there was a tendency to sort of hide behind other people. So that Jewish racism would become white racism, or Jewish involvement in the slave trade would become Portuguese involvement, and so on. I had a very graphic demonstration of this shortly after my controversy arose, when that Sunday morning program, The Week with David Brinkley, I think it's an ABC TV program, I believe. Well, you know, one of the more prestigious Sunday morning talk programs. David Brinkley, I suppose, is considered a very authoritative figure. But amazingly to me, the question of the Jewish involvement in the slave trade was considered so important by these folks in the major media that they actually spent a segment one morning on The Week with David Brinkley. This is around about 1994, I think, discussing me and the whole question of the Jewish involvement in the African slave trade. And David Brinkley, and I, in my book, The Jewish Onslaught, I refer to this incident, and I refer to David Brinkley as speaking with the authority of the blissfully ignorant. And David Brinkley, with great authority, announced that Jews had nothing to do with the slave trade. He said, the Portuguese, yes, but not the Jews. You know, he said, Professor Martin at Wellesley College is insane, you know, and Cokie Roberts said, oh, they should boycott his classes, he should be fired, and all kinds of things for saying that Jews were involved in the slave trade. But come to find out that many of these Portuguese that are, in fact, perhaps the majority of these Portuguese, you know, slave ship owners and so on, that David Brinkley was talking about were, in fact, Jews. Some were what they called Moranos, Jews who pretended to convert to Christianity, then declared their Jewishness at the first opportunity and so on. But here was just one of many examples where the Jewish presence in this trade tended to be camouflaged, you know, under other kinds of categorizations. So then I was just only dimly aware then of this whole question of the Jewish involvement in the slave trade until sometime around 1992 or thereabouts, I received a little postcard in the mail. It was a bulk mailing advertising a book published by the Nation of Islam's Historical Research Department. The book was entitled The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews. And I ordered the book and I read it. I was very impressed by it. And as a good professor, you know, I always try, despite the fact that I've taught for many years, but I always try to keep my students abreast of latest developments. So here was something that fascinated me, something that surprised me since I had been unaware of it. And I did what I always do in that situation, and that is I decided to incorporate some of this new information in my African-American survey history class. I actually used the book in a Caribbean history class for one semester without incident. I used it in the following semester in an African-American history class, and that's when, as the saying goes, all hell broke loose. But before I describe what happened, let me spend a few minutes summarizing the facts of Jewish involvement in the slave trade. What precisely was the nature of the Jewish involvement in the African slave trade? The Jewish involvement in the African slave trade begins, as far as I can tell, long before the actual slave trade across the Atlantic itself. The transatlantic slave trade has its immediate origins around about 1441. When Portuguese sailors landed on the West African coast and kidnapped a few Africans, brought them back to Europe. Africans were brought back to Europe, to Portugal and to Spain as part of that particular trade for several years. Columbus, of course, arrived in the Americas in 1492, approximately half a century later. In 1502, the first Africans were brought to the Caribbean. The Caribbean is where the transatlantic slave trade begins, and many Americans don't know that. But for over 100 years before Africans were brought as slaves to this country, the United States of America, Africans were being brought across the Atlantic to the Caribbean, to places like Hispaniola, the island which today is shared by Haiti and the Dominican Republic, and to other places as well. So it seems to me that Jewish involvement then in that transatlantic slave trade precedes by many, many years, perhaps by 1,000 years, the actual beginnings of the transatlantic slave trade. And let me explain. It seems to me that the most important theoretical underpinning for that transatlantic slave trade was what has come to be known in many quarters as the Hamitic myth. Some people call it the curse of Ham story. When the slave trade developed, beginning in 1441 and for hundreds of years thereafter, people who prosecuted that trade looked around for intellectual justification, for rationalizations, for pretexts, if you will. And a variety of pretexts were advanced to justify the slave trade, to allow people to sleep well at night, you know, for their consciences to be clear. One justification was that Africans were heathens. They weren't Christian, they were heathens, and therefore it was all right to enslave heathens. It would not be all right to enslave one's Christian brother, but it would be okay. It would be morally justifiable to enslave a heathen. That was one kind of rationale that was an advance to justify the slave trade. Another rationale was that Africans were less than human. Africans were devoid of reason, could not reason, were a subspecies of creature. They weren't human. And therefore, again, whereas there might have been some moral opprobrium attached to enslaving one's fellow human beings, in the case of Africans, since they weren't quite human, that kind of treatment of Africans was okay.
Tune into Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple, every Saturday morning from 9 to 11 a.m. on the Uhuru Radio Network. We examine issues that affect Caribbean and Caribbean American nationals, both at home and across the diaspora. If you're not listening to Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple, here on the Uhuru Radio Network, then your radio is not on.
You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
The most important, however, of all of these rationales that was advanced to try to justify the slave trade was the question of this Hamitic myth. That is, the notion that Africans were cursed by God himself, that Africans had been cursed by God, that God had decreed in his wisdom a very long time ago that Africans would be forever the hewers of wood and the drawers of water for other races. The authority for this idea was said to reside in the book of Genesis, in a story in the book of Genesis. Now, there's a story in the book of Genesis, and there's an interpretation of that story that allowed it to be used to justify African slavery, and they're two different things. The story in Genesis is in Genesis. It's been in the Bible ever since. But the sort of spin that was put on that story that enabled it to become the basis for the Hamitic myth actually comes out of the Talmud, the Jewish holy book, the Talmud, somewhere around 500 AD or thereabouts, the Babylonian Talmud. Let me just describe the difference between the story as it appears in the Bible and the story as it was spun in the Talmud. According to the Bible, Noah, after the flood, apparently had a vineyard someplace, and he partook of the wine that was produced out of his vineyard. He got himself drunk one night, went into his tent, took his clothes off, as people often do when they get drunk. And according to the biblical story, he had three sons, Ham, Shem, and Japheth. Ham apparently entered the area where his father was lying in his drunken, naked stupor. And Ham, in an act of disrespect, gazed upon his father's nakedness. And apparently went back outside and informed his two other brothers of his father's condition. According to the biblical story, the two other brothers then came in to inside the tent or wherever, and out of respect for their father, they kind of backed into the tent. They would not look directly at him in his naked condition. They backed into the tent, they covered him with some kind of a garment. And according to the biblical story, when Noah revived, when he, you know, arose from his drunken stupor and realized what had happened, he then cursed Ham's son Canaan and all of his descendants forever, and said that they would be the servants of the descendants of the other two brothers, Shem and Japheth. Somewhere along the line, I'm not quite sure how it come, but somewhere along the line, somebody came up with the notion that Ham was the progenitor of the African race, and Shem was the progenitor of the Asian race, and Japheth was the progenitor of the European race. So Noah had three sons of three different races, and he cursed his African son and their descendants and said that those descendants would be the slaves, the servants of the Asian branch of the family and also the European branch of the family forever. And that's as far as the biblical story goes. The Talmud, which of course, my understanding of the Talmud, I'm no expert in the Talmud, but my understanding is that the Talmud consists of interpretations, what they call glosses, on various biblical stories. And these glosses or interpretations or spins are supposed to give people who subscribe to the Judaic religion a sort of an authoritative guide as to how to interpret the biblical stories and whatnot. So what the Talmud did then, the Talmud came along, the Babylonian Talmud, around about 500 or so AD, and proceeded to spin this biblical story, and for reasons that are unknown to me. But Ham, again, was said to be the progenitor of the African race. Now, interestingly enough, I read someplace that early Christians also accepted this notion of Ham being some sort of progenitor of the African race. But apparently, in the Christian tradition, the kind of, you know, overtly racist implications of that fact didn't develop in the same way as it developed in the Judaic tradition. According to the Talmud, Ham was the original African, and when God, through Noah, cursed Ham and his son Canaan and all his descendants, he was in fact cursing the African race. Now, this was the unique new element to the story that the Talmud originated, that the curse on Ham and Canaan was not only a curse on an individual and his family, but it was a curse on a race. So here, this is the contribution then of the Talmud, that God, through Noah, cursed the African race. And the Talmud proceeded to embellish the story in the most delightful, should I say, ways. For example, the Talmud said that there was ample proof that God was in fact cursing the African race. It said, for example, that because Ham had gazed upon Noah's nakedness in the dark of night, that the African race was henceforth turned black. So that the blackness of the African became a sort of a visible indication of that curse. The Talmud said that because it was dark at night when Ham entered that tent and looked upon his father's nakedness, he had to open his eyes, he had to buck his eyes, as they say in America, to see his father in the darkness. And that's why Africans had big eyes. The Talmud said, and here, and I'm going to quote all this exactly in a minute. I'm not making this up. It sounds incredible, but I'm actually paraphrasing a gentleman by the name of Harold Brackman, a man who worked until recently for the Simon Wiesenthal Center of all agencies. He wrote all of this in his dissertation. And it might not surprise you to discover that once people like myself began quoting what this guy Brackman wrote, I'm sure you can guess what happened next. And that is that Brackman denied he had ever written this stuff. This stuff is in Brackman's PhD dissertation. It's called The Ebb and Flow of History. Anybody here can easily read it. You can get it in any library. If they don't have it, they'll get it for you into library loans. It's called The Ebb and Flow of History. It's a PhD dissertation, I think in the history department at UCLA, 1977, by Harold D. Brackman, who I believe up to a couple of years ago, maybe even now, is or was until recently a functionary of the Simon Wiesenthal, or is it Wiesenthal Center? But despite the fact that his writings were clearly in the public record, that anybody, an undergrad student, can access this stuff and check it for themselves, once the story got out, he quickly denied it ever written this. This man actually wrote letters to the New York Times. I believe I have the actual footnotes here in the Jewish Onslaught concerning all this. This man wrote letters to the New York Times. He wrote a slew of letters to black publications all over this country denying all of this stuff, even though it's right there on the record. So I'm using very good evidence here when I paraphrase what he's saying. Brackman tells us that because, and here it gets to be totally hilarious. Now, these Jewish rabbis, the sages, they call them, wise men who put together this Talmud, they actually invented, they sort of elaborated on the biblical story. It's like a jazz musician who improvises. Well, they improvise on the story. They did a whole elaborate improvisation in the story. And somehow, Lord knows how come, but they came up with the notion that Ham, when he went into that tent and looked upon his naked father, Noah, that Ham buggered his father. He had anal intercourse with his father. And because he had anal intercourse with his father, that's the reason, and here I'm citing Blackman, that's the reason why part of the curse was to give black men large sexual organs. So all of this was part of the curse. The black skin, the big eyes, even the kinky hair too, big sexual organs, all of this. So as amazing as this may seem, this transpired 1,000 years before the beginnings of the transatlantic slave trade. And when the slave trade came into being, this notion of the Hamitic curse was revived, and it became, both for Jews and for Christians, it became the most pervasive of all the attempts to rationalize that slave trade. Let me quote the exact words of Harold Brackman, lest you suspect that I'm making this up. I'm quoting here from Harold Brackman, the dissertation I mentioned a minute ago, The Ebb and Flow of History. Quote, There is no denying, this is on page 34, in case anybody who has a book feels like reading along with me. I know several of you have the book out there. This is on page 34, in the middle of the page, second new paragraph. There is no denying that the Babylonian Talmud was the first source, and listen to how unequivocal he is here. It was the first, the very first. In other words, this is Bachman from the Simon Wiesenthal Center acknowledging that the Talmud was the one, was the place that invented the story of the Hamitic curse. There is no denying that the Babylonian Talmud was the first source to read a negrophobic content into the episode. Here he is referring to the episode of Ham looking upon his father's nakedness. He goes on to suggest that these early sages, some of them, you know, impose this homosexual spin onto the story. Quote, he says, Rab is one of these sages. He says, Rab maintained that Ham had unmanned Noah. So Ham, according to this sage, had actually castrated his father. While Samuel is some other sage, Samuel claimed that he had buggered him as well. Both unmanned him and buggered him. Now, how this arose out of the biblical story, I'll never understand. Let me continue to quote from Brackman here in his dissertation. Quote, he is discussing here various, slightly diverging, variants of this myth. He goes on to say, quote, the more important version of the myth, that's the Hamitic myth, however, ingeniously ties in the origins of blackness and of other real and imagined negroid traits with Noah's curse itself. According to it, that's according to this most popular version of the Hamitic myth, according to it, Ham is told by his outraged father that because you have abused me in the darkness of the night, your children shall be born black and ugly. This is in the Talmud. Because you have twisted your head to cause me embarrassment, they shall have kinky hair and red eyes. So if you ever wondered about the origin of the kinky hair and the red eyes of black folk, here you have it. Because your lips jested at my exposure, theirs shall swell. That's why black folks have thick lips. And because you neglected my nakedness, they, that is your children, the children of Ham and Canaan, they shall go naked with their shamefully elongated male members exposed for all to see. So there you have the origin of a whole variety of stereotypes pertaining to African folk. So the Hamitic myth then is where you really have to begin, you know, in terms of a discussion of the Jewish role in the slave trade. They provided the rationale par excellence for the prosecution of that slave trade. Some years after the Babylonian Talmud, sometime in the Middle Ages, a man who I believe they consider to be perhaps one of the greatest philosophers ever, a man by the name of Maimonides, actually also contributed to that notion of Africans being subhuman when in his famous book, Guide to the Perplexed, when he, Maimonides, suggested, again, that African people were less than human, that they were somewhere between monkeys and human beings. This is Maimonides, a man who is one of the most revered of all of these Jewish sages. So by the time then that the slave trade came along, when, you know, there was this tradition which had been floating around Europe, and it was seized upon then by the slave traders, Jews and Gentiles alike, as a basic rationale. There were other areas, you know, in which the Jewish presence was very manifest. For example, although I don't know a whole lot about this aspect of it, but my understanding is that Jews were in fact very prominent as slave traders, you know, in the centuries prior to the beginning of the Atlantic slave trade. My understanding is that Jews, you know, for many years sold Muslim slaves to Christians and sold Christian slaves to Muslims, and they were sort of accepted as the slave middlemen by both sides. And this is, you know, a long time before the Atlantic slave trade came about. The earliest multinational corporation involved in the Atlantic slave trade was something called the Dutch West India Company. And again, it often surprises people to discover that even in this early period, you know, globalization was already a very fairly entrenched phenomenon. The slave trade was a great example of globalization. Here you had the Dutch West India Company, out of Holland, of course, which went to West Africa. They had their own private army. They established forts on the West African coast. They had their own fleet of ships and so on. They had their own administrators. Sometimes they would govern areas. They had their own governors, administrators, and whatnot. They were almost like, it was almost like colonization, via private enterprise. It was like privatized colonization. And all of this, of course, transpired with the sanction of European governments. These were like surrogate governments almost, these chartered companies, as they were often called. So the Dutch West India Company, in the 1600s then, was the pioneer in this kind of multinational, globalized prosecution of the slave trade. And apparently a large number of the shareholders, the stockholders, in this Dutch West India Company were Jews. The Jews had been chased out of Portugal and Spain. They had been chased out of all kinds of places. They found some respite from their wanderings in Holland. They became an influential factor in Holland. And I've seen a variety of figures. This, too, is an area of some controversy. I've seen estimates varying from 25% to 50% concerning the stake of Jewish stockholders in the Dutch West India Company. But suffice it to say that they were an important element in the Dutch West India Company, which was the preeminent entity carrying on the slave trade in the early period. The Dutch West India Company was responsible for importing, the earliest slaves to places like Brazil, to some parts of the Caribbean, either directly or indirectly, I think, to this country as well in a very early period in the 17th century. In many areas in the Americas, Jews were a dominant element in the slave trade. In Brazil, for example, in the 17th century, Jews were a dominant element in the slave trade. They owned a large number of the plantations. They were often very importantly positioned in other aspects, not necessarily the plantation aspects, but things like, say, the importation of slaves, things like the warehousing of slaves, things like the auctioning of slaves, things like the provisioning of slaves, things like manning slave ships, provisioning slave ships. In New England, for example, at the height of the Atlantic slave trade, rum became a major economic venture in New England, places like Providence, Rhode Island, places like Boston and so on. And rum was a major factor in the slave trade because rum was one of the major items of trade, one of the major items that slave ships carried when they went to West Africa to trade and exchange for slaves and so on. And I believe that at one point all the rum distilleries in Boston were owned by Jews. I think there was something like 18 or something like that rum distilleries. So in all of these areas, both directly and in terms of ancillary industries feeding the slave trade, Jews were very, very important. Apart from Brazil, Jews were again dominant factors in many other parts of the area. For example, in Curacao. Curacao, a Dutch island in the Caribbean, the majority of folks involved in the slave trade in Curacao were Jews. At one point in Suriname, which again was a Dutch colony right next to Brazil in South America, Jews were again a very important part of the slave trade in Suriname. There was an English soldier by the name of John Steadman who went to Suriname in the late 1700s as part of a mercenary force raised by the Dutch to try to fight against the Maroon slaves. Those were the escaped slaves who established an independent existence in the interior and gave the slave regime a lot of trouble. And Steadman wrote a very fascinating book concerning his experiences in Suriname, and there are several references in Steadman's book to the presence of Jewish slave owners and so on. There was one large plantation area in Suriname called Jew Savannah. And according to Steadman, the Jews were very often the most cruel of the slave owners. They played a very prominent role in torturing slaves and so on. He has several little vignettes that he mentions concerning the kind of cruelties that were meted out to slaves by both Jewish men and women. There's one case he describes there of a Maroon slave leader, a man called Joli Coeur, French Joli Coeur. Beautiful heart, don't know where he got that name from, Joli Coeur. But apparently Joli Coeur, again, was a rebellious slave. He led a slave uprising. And on one occasion, apparently, the Maroons were fighting against, some of these people from Jew Savannah. And according to Steadman, they captured a Jewish slave owner named Schultz. And apparently Schultz was the man that Jolly Care, you know, the slave owner that Jolly Care had escaped from as a young boy. And Jolly Care remembered that this guy Schultz had apparently ravaged his mother and so on. And Stedman describes a very, very, very harsh vengeance that was wrought by Jolly Care on Schultz. He flayed him, cut his skin off, then used his skin to keep the powder dry, the powder for his cannon or whatever, and used his head to play football with.
You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
Black is back. Yes, Black is back. The Black is Back Coalition for Peace, Social Justice, and Reparations will lead a national march and rally on the White House in Washington, D.C. on November 13th this year, where young black men and Afghan men, women, and children dying as a result of U.S.-led wars of aggression in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, in Africa, and on the streets of the United States. It is time for the black community to stand up and say, hell no, we won't go. We oppose Obama's wars. Join the Black is Back Coalition in Washington, D.C. on November 13th. For more information, call 202-681-7040 or email info@blackisbackcoalition.org. For it on to D.C.
Jews were also very prominently present in non-Dutch parts of the Caribbean, places like Barbados, places like Jamaica, St. Thomas, and many of the other islands as well. That has arisen concerning, you know, whether Jews were the dominant element or not, or whether they were even an important element. But much of that discussion has taken place in the context of the United States of America. In the U.S., it may not be correct to say that slaves were as dominant in the slave trade as they were in parts of, say, the Caribbean or Central America. Nevertheless, Jews were an important part of the slave trade in this country, in the U.S. of A. Anyway, in fact, in the U.S. of A., Jews apparently played a role in the slave trade that was greater than the numbers in the overall population would suggest. Just as in 1992, a study done based on the Forbes magazine list of the richest people in America for 1992. A study based on that list discovered that something like 33% of the billionaires in the US of A were Jews, based on the Forbes list of 1992, at a time when Jews claimed to be 2.5% of the United States population. So just as in 1992, they were overrepresented in the high echelons of this country, just so during the slave trade, even though their numbers may have been relatively small. And many of the people who have tried to refute, you know, the suggestion that Jews were prominently involved in the slave trade in this country, many of those people have put forward figures suggesting that Jews were only a very minute portion of the overall American population. Yes, they were a very small percentage of the American population, but that has nothing to do with their role in the slave trade, the importance of their role. The role was much greater than the numbers in the overall population would suggest. As a matter of fact, a Jewish historian has done a study, the 1830 census in the South, and has come up with the conclusion that something like 75% of Jewish households in the South, in this country, in 1830, owned slaves, whereas the percentage for white households generally was only something like 36%. So the Jews were approximately twice as likely as non-Jews, as a white population, to own slaves in this country, in the South, in 1830. So again, we're talking here about, you know, proportions rather than absolute figures. Some of the most important slave ship owners in colonial America were Jews. You know, perhaps the best known of these is a man called Aaron Lopez. I noticed that many of these persons had Spanish or Portuguese-sounding last names. and that's because they were Sephardic Jews. When this whole question arose, you know, around my involvement in all this, many Jews were heard to say that there were no Jews in America prior to the 1880s. In fact, Nathan Glaser, a very famous academic out of Harvard University, who should know better, he actually wrote that there's no way that Jews could be responsible for the slave trade in America, since there were no Jews here, he said, before 1880. Of course, there were European Jews here in the 19th century before 1880, German Jews and so on. But there were Sephardic Jews here from the very beginning, you know, from the 17th century, there were Sephardic Jews coming in here to New York and later to other places. So hence the Spanish-sounding names like Nunez, names like Lopez, names like Castro, interestingly enough, names like Ferreira, Herrera, Gomez. All of these names, interestingly enough, suggested Jewish origin in colonial times. As somebody was saying to me yesterday, you could usually get a hint of their Jewishness from their first names. The last name might be Gomez or Nunez or Castro, but their first name might be Jacob or David or something like that. Aaron. So Aaron Lopez was out of Newport, Rhode Island. He was one of the largest slave ship owners in colonial America. This man had a fleet of ships for many years. He sent his ships to West Africa. They traveled from West Africa to the Caribbean, to Barbados, to Jamaica, St. Thomas, places like that. He had members of his family situated in the Caribbean. He had a whole network going on, and you know, and he brought slaves back here as well. Many of his slaves helped to build some famous synagogue in Newport, Rhode Island in colonial times. Despite the fact that, oh, by the way, Jews were also involved in other aspects of the trade. My time is running out, so I'm going to be quick here. For example, they were involved, again, in provisioning slaves here in this country, as they were in other areas as well, you know, providing the kind of coarse cloth that slaves wore, things like that. They had a hand in providing the kinds of restraints and handcuffs and chains and padlocks and those kinds of things that were used to sort of enforce servitude of the Africans as well. Interestingly enough, despite the prominence of Jews in this African slave trade in this country, in the US of A, their prominence in the African slave trade was not matched by a similar prominence in the abolitionist movement. In fact, some of the Christian abolitionists noted this apparent contradiction. In fact, let me quote you here a very interesting statement put out by Christian abolitionists. This is 1853. It's from the American and Foreign Anti-Slavery Society report, 1853. Quote, "The Jews of the United States have never taken any steps, whatever, with regard to the slavery question. As citizens, they deem it their policy to have everyone choose whichever side he may deem best to promote his own interests and the welfare of his country," etc., etc., etc. This statement concludes as follows, quote, "The objects of so much mean prejudice and unrighteous oppression as the Jews have been for ages, surely they, it would seem, more than any other denomination, ought to be the enemies of caste and friends of universal freedom." Such, however, was not the case. There were very few and far between as far as the abolitionist movement was concerned. So this then is the reality of Jewish involvement in the slave trade. And that's the reality that I faced then in 1993 when I stumbled into this controversy simply by exposing my students to the fact that Jews, like everybody else, had been involved. And of course, I did not deny the involvement of anybody else. I did not even deny the involvement of African collaborators. You know, for years I had taught Christian involvement. And up to now, I'm still somewhat surprised that everybody else, you know, seems willing to acknowledge their involvement in the trade. But for some reason, this is the only group that not only refuses to acknowledge the involvement, but becomes, you know, very, 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 very upset when that involvement is mentioned. I won't have time to go into my particular situation. It's all here in the Jewish onslaught. I'll just say very briefly before I wrap up, I was just told I have about 3 more minutes left. But this controversy assumed enormous proportions. I'm still surprised. You know, here was something as simple as my teaching this information, which is all well documented. The book that I was using, The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, put out by the Nation of Islam, that book relies almost 100% on Jewish sources. But what is interesting, though, is that even though the Jewish academics and authoritative sources like the Encyclopedia, Judaica, even though these sort of academic, esoteric Jewish sources were quite forthcoming in acknowledging their role in the slave trade, the popular Jewish press and the popular Jewish populace, I guess, many of them were either unaware of all of this or refused to believe it. I remember some Jewish alumni writing into the to the Wellesley College alumni magazine, suggesting that my teaching, you know, the Jewish involvement in the slave trade, was akin to suspending the rules of grammar in an English class. The end result of all this is that the role of Jews in the slave trade, something which was unknown to many folks prior to 1993, something which was largely unknown to me because of the hullabaloo created by the Jewish media and so on, I think that has, in a sense, had an effect that they perhaps did not anticipate. And that is that something which was in fact a secret relationship is no longer secret. The whole world is now aware of the fact, thanks to the hullabaloo created by the Jewish media, of the Jewish involvement in the slave trade. And even though there has been an incredible effort since 1993 to, on the part of the Jewish media to sort of counterattack, for example, the Amistad movie was part of that counterattack. The Amistad movie very subtly suggested that Africans were the ones responsible for their own enslavement. The Amistad movie, you know, put out by Steven Spielberg, actually had an African slave. Imagine this. Steven Spielberg actually had an African slave in the Amistad movie saying, I did not see the movie, by the way, I refused to see it, but I was told that Spielberg actually had an African slave in this movie saying that he was so sorry for the great suffering that, you know, the Jews had gone through, you know, and whatnot, and that nobody in the world, this was an African slave. A man who was on death row, in jail, fighting for his life as an African slave. And Spielberg has this man saying that he had just read the Bible and these folks had suffered so much, etc., etc. Nobody in the world had suffered as much as they had. The whole question of late of an alleged slave trade in the Sudan. Now, there may indeed be a Muslim slave trade in the Sudan. There may, I know, it doesn't, you know, bother me one way or the other. But the whole attempt to elevate this into a new great anti-slavery crusade, that too is one of the means by which the Jewish establishment has tried to kind of cover up, you know, their own involvement in the slave trade. I don't know how many books on the slave trade have been published by Jews in the last 6-7 years. I have lost count, but it could easily be a dozen. You know, they keep just churning out these books. But the more noise they make, the more people become aware of the fact that, you know, that there is a Jewish involvement in the slave trade. So I think that, to a large extent, I think they have kind of shot themselves in the foot this time around. They have let the genie out of the bottle. Thank you. Available. I've come from Jewish.
Find out now, you ought to be aware of people who don't know their history. It's tragedy. So know your history, black man, find your roots, African. Know your history, black man, find your own identity. Identity. I said it's a serious time.
Yes, welcome back to Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple. You had been listening for the last few minutes, or last hour, I should say, to Tony Martin, Professor Tony Martin, and I'm sure that was some food for thought. I'd like to thank Arnold Talleyrand, I'm sorry, author and historian, as he talked about the history of Haiti. So you have yourself a safe week. We shall see you next week here on the Uhuru Radio Network from 9 to 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Tell a friend. Be good to yourself.
So know your history, black man. Find your roots, Africa. Know your history, black man. Find your own identity. Identity. This is a serious time. That we're living in such a serious, serious time. That we're living in. Emancipate yourself, Somali. Free yourself from mental slavery. People who can't live in a unity will always be chained and never be free. So know your history, black man. Find your roots.